Today's show is sponsored by the multi-Academy Award-winning First World War-themed film, 1917, which is available to own starting March 10th on digital streaming and on March 24th on 4K Ultra HD and Blu-ray. More on what's available then at the end of our upcoming interview with Fred Kaplan.
It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. That is a wonderful quote by, what would you call him, founding father of modern Soviet communism, maybe? Leon Trotsky? The guy Stalin had an assassin go halfway around the world to assassinate with an axe pick, so dangerous was he. It's a great line, though, isn't it? You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. Says a lot, doesn't it? It says basically that it doesn't matter if you want to go think about happy things or focus on other pursuits and things maybe that you have more control over. After all, what do I have to do with a giant war that may start with government somewhere? I'll just go about my life and do my own thing and let those people worry about their own things, except their own things will turn into your own things at some point, right? The war will be interested in you. I thought about that when I thought about what would happen if we could rationally divide our thinking energy based on threat level and triage and try to come up with an idea of how much time we should spend on this or that given issue, right? How much time, how much mental energy, in a realistic sense, should an educated individual in a modern society devote to thinking about X? In this case, we're going to talk about nuclear war, something that I think a rational person would have to admit, if you thought about it for 5 seconds, belongs somewhere up near the top of your triage list. It used to be there. People used to think a lot about this when they thought it could happen at any minute. The funny part is it could still kind of happen at any minute. You'd be surprised how quickly the tensions could ramp up and we could be in a situation where everybody forgets about that virus that mutated that might be coming over here and might give you flu-like symptoms, might kill millions of people like the 1919 flu. All of that starts to fade into the background when you start talking about people using, you know, serious megatonnage on your fellow man. It is also funny to me in a triage sense that when we think about the use of nuclear weapons today, we think about an infinitely less dangerous scenario than the one I grew up with. We think about some rogue state somewhere getting a few nuclear weapons and using them somewhere. And it's dangerous because we think about this as a much less controlled system. So the likelihood of something happening is much worse, even if the worst-case scenario is nowhere near as bad as what would happen if, you know, superpowers lobbed missiles at each other with MIRVed warheads on the, you know, it's one of those things where you think, okay, North Korea is a bigger nuclear thing to worry about than Russia is because North Korea might use their weapons and Russia's pretty safe right now. But right now is the operative phrase. Things change on a dime. History doesn't teach lessons, right? But it teaches that things change on a dime. Doesn't teach you when the next thing that will change on a dime is. But there's plenty of examples that show the pattern, right? You might be worried about this coronavirus today. 2 weeks of saber rattling and a degeneration in world tensions, and all of a sudden you're thinking about what we probably should have been thinking about the whole time, given where it probably belongs on the triage level. The possibility, in fact, the fact that it's easier than you might think to have happen, of nuclear war, not a nuclear bomb being used, not a minor exchange from some third world rogue state that doesn't know how to handle these things, but a true threat from one country to another involving states that do know how to handle these things and have thought about what you would do if you needed to handle them for decades now. One of the best writers that you'll ever read talking about this question of thinking about how you would use or prevent the use of these weapons is a guy named Fred Kaplan. You should probably call him Dr. Fred Kaplan. He's got a doctorate, but He's an author who wrote a book called The Wizards of Armageddon, among others. We use that book as source material for our Destroyer of Worlds podcast. And it's fantastic stuff. The people who had to try to get their mind around the mental challenge of human beings living with that kind of weapons power, the whole thing is fascinating. And then getting them together in groups to I mean, it's interesting stuff. And he's just come out with a new book called The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. So it takes like what we did or what he did in the earlier books or what we did in the Destroyer of Worlds and brings it up to modern times, which in a really weird way makes it more chilling because you can't just say, wow, things got really hot during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It must have been heavy, right? Because Kaplan's bringing you up to the way the situation kind of is currently. And that doesn't just make it heavy. It makes it scary and real and current. These weapons have not only not gone away, they've become much more accurate. Much more deadly is a better way to put them. We haven't necessarily gotten any more intelligent about how to use them. I love the phrase, and this is how we'll start the interview we did with Kaplan today. I love the phrase that was used as a blurb on his book. You know what the blurbs are, the comments on the back or in the flaps, and Chuck Klosterman gave me one I liked in my book. He called it an apocalyptic discotheque, which I thought was a really wonderful turn of phrase. But I love somebody called Kaplan the preeminent Dr. Strangelove whisperer. And so I started by asking him that. That's a heck of a nickname, isn't it? Or a heck of a blurb? Anyway, without further ado, my conversation with Fred Kaplan, author of The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. You can read Kaplan's regular column, by the way, War Stories in Slate. He's written for everyone. So without further ado, Fred Kaplan. The first thing is, I have to tell you, I absolutely think it is one of the best blurbs I've ever read on the back of the book, the one that calls you the world's preeminent Dr. Strangelove whisperer. How do you feel about that? It's an interesting thing to be considered an expert on.
Well, I guess what he meant by that, this was from Tim Naftali, the presidential historian, is that I do get the kind of Dr. Strangelove types, nuclear strategists, that sort of thing, to talk to me about stuff. Now, one reason for this is that many years ago, I studied in graduate school at MIT with William Kaufman, who was one of them, and also with a couple of other people who were involved in nuclear policy in the late 50s to mid 60s, George Rathjens and Jack Ruina. So I could ask people questions, sort of speaking their tongue. I understood how the analysis of you know, the exchange calculations, as they were called, were done. So, you know, I seemed to be one of the tribe, and they could open up to me better.
Okay, so if we talk about a personality type, certain kinds of personality types make good actors and actresses. Certain types of personality people make, you know, titans of business. If you had to sort of give us a short description of and obviously there's probably not one size fits all, but is there a type that's attracted to this sort of Wizards of Armageddon job description?
Well, you know, in the early days, and what we're talking about in the 1950s through the early 60s, let's say, I mean, there really was a Cold War. I mean, you know as well as anybody that this wasn't some fabrication of paranoia. There was a real Cold War. People really thought there was a good chance that there was going to be a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. So the kind of person who was, say, at the Rand Corporation back in those days with the Hudson Institute examining this, first thought they were dealing with a real thing, and they saw it in their powers and their mission to enhance deterrence, in other words, to do things that would maybe make sure that this war doesn't happen, and then to limit damage if it did. So they had a kind of a crusader image, but they were also, by and large, economists, social scientists, mathematicians. In other words, they saw that the discipline in which they had been trained had some unique power to deal with this problem. Herman Kahn, in his book on thermonuclear war, said that what he was trying to do was to create a vocabulary in which these problems can be discussed rationally. It was sort of a religion of rationality, that rationality, defined as mathematical calculation, can get us out of not just this problem, but, you know, for a while, the sort of elevation of systems analysis and things like that. There were people who thought this could solve all the problems of the world. I have to say, the kind of person who does this for a living now, after, you know, the kind of elevation, mystification of rationality has been, you know, has crumbled in the face of all kinds of things, from the Vietnam War to the breakdown of all kinds of social processes. I have a little less. I don't know if you could put it down to a type of what kind of person gets in this, at least in a very deep, deep way now, unless they're a military officer. And it may be that there aren't people like this anymore. And as a result, maybe these problems aren't dealt with rationally, but maybe they could never be dealt with rationally.
You know, it's fascinating if you look at how much ink and time and effort what went in the 1950s, 1960s, and into the 1970s towards exactly what you're talking about, the almost Spock-like analysis of the game itself and the various options and the rational, you know, counter moves and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And to talk about, I was struck by what you said, that maybe there aren't those people today. And then all of a sudden it popped into my head that I don't hear those kinds of conversations today. Has this all been so internalized that we don't have to have, maybe that the first few decades were the discovery period and this stuff's all been absorbed? Or is this something that went out of fashion when the seeming inevitability, or at least extreme likelihood, of a general nuclear exchange went away?
Well, I think for a while it was internalized. To the point where, you know, I conclude, my first book was The Wizards of Armageddon.
Which was awesome, by the way. We used it as a source. It was fantastic.
Oh, thanks. But, I mean, it was about these people. That's mainly what it was about. And how they had influence on policy. And I ended the book by noting that, and this book came out in 1983, that the sort of second generation of these people, you know, the Cold War was still going on. They had so absorbed the analytical framework of the founding fathers at Rand and so forth that they had come to think that it was real, that it reflect a reality, that these ideas had been hammered home so often in books and treatises. It was almost like the stone of dogma. Whereas, you know, you talk to the first generation people, you know, they'll admit, like, hey, you know, we never knew whether this was real. In fact, we thought it was unlikely that you could limit a nuclear war or control how it would spin out. But if there was any chance that you could do it, at least we should try, instead of blowing up the world all in one stroke. Now, though, at least until a couple of years ago, for about the previous 30 years, nobody was thinking about nuclear war, nuclear weapons at all. The Cold War was over. You know, we were all on a holiday from history. Quite the contrary to it being internalized, I think all of these ideas have been, at least among the broad, educated public interested in international relations, let's say, forgotten. And one reason I wrote this new book, The Bomb, is precisely because of that. When Donald Trump came out of his, you know, golf clubhouse in Edmonston, New Jersey on August 8th, 2017, and said that if North Korea keeps making threatening noises and testing nukes and missiles, he will rain fire and fury on North Korea like the earth has never seen. And, you know, that was kind of a provocative, first, the rhetoric alone, but second, he wasn't saying that if they attack us, we'll rain fire and fury, but just if they develop the capability to attack us, he would do that. And that got people very worried and nervous about the possible prospect of nuclear war for the first time in decades. But this nervousness took form in the shape of a kind of vague anxiety, because people had forgotten all of the discussion about nuclear strategy and so forth, if they ever knew it. And so I thought, well, it's time maybe to take another look at the history of this thing.
I have a persistent devil's advocate side in me, and there's a part of me that thinks that the awakening to how dangerous it is perhaps to have a single individual in charge of the world's most powerful arsenal ever, I think people maybe were a little complacent because they felt like the person in power would never violate whatever. We can trust, you know, this individual to act responsibly. It's almost like you had to get somebody that shattered that sense of trust to maybe give the right amount of attention to a command and control problem that, if you look at the Constitution, seems ridiculous, right? You put the power to launch a war into one person's hands alone. And we can talk about, you know, the actual restrictions that might be on a person mm-hmm. in a second. But I mean, it seems like that, and I always look at it as a technological question, right? You don't have time for Congress to deliberate and everything when the missiles are in the air. But I mean, it seems like maybe if there was an upside to this whole thing, it's that people are examining this obvious hole in our whole, you know, defense strategy and constitutional design now in a way that they weren't when we had the Obama presidency or the Bush presidency or the Reagan presidency. Does that ring true in any sense?
You could take this all the way back. Yeah, I think it is true. I think one thing that Trump has done is to sort of slapped us awake to the reality that, hey, you know, maybe we'd forgotten, but these thousands of nuclear weapons are still here and always have been here. And there's a whole machinery, a whole apparatus that is planning how to use them in various contingencies and keeping them maintained. You know, the new defense budget that Trump just put out has $29 billion devoted to nuclear weapons and the things that carry them. That was about a 17% increase over the previous year. So, yeah, these things are still here. Now, what people will do about it, I don't know. There was a hearing in 2017 around the same time as Fire and Fury. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Republican chairman at the time, Bob Corker, suddenly realized, I mean, you'd think that someone in that position would have known this already, but kind of suddenly realized that the president has the sole power to blow up the world if he wants to. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And so he held a hearing, and it was the first hearing that Congress had held on this subject since the mid-70s. I mean, that tells you something right there. It was an open hearing, wasn't reported on much. I watched it on C-SPAN 3. It was live. And it was the notion, the premise of the hearing was confirmed that, that the president, it's the human factor is the deciding element. Now, did Congress do anything about this? No. And the issue is brought up. You're right. It's one thing if the missiles are coming and you've got 20 minutes warning, you don't have time to, you know, call hearings or assemble the group of eight in Congress to discuss this. But they were talking about, well, what if the president is contemplating a first strike? And even not even so much a preemptive strike, but a preventive strike, say against North Korea, if they're starting to test ICBMs and nuclear weapons. That's a legitimate question, I think. You do have time. Do you want it all to rest in the power of one person? But nothing was done. There was a moment in the hearing where a Democratic senator said, look, let's cut the politeness out of this. We're holding this hearing because the president is erratic, he has poor judgment, and he might get us into a war. And the remarkable thing is that no Republican senator on the panel disagreed with this, you know, didn't say that's outrageous or anything like that. And one of the people testifying was a retired general named Bob Kaler. He had recently been the commander of Strategic Command. And he came away from the hearing very distressed because To his mind, hey, if Congress wants to change the rules about launch authority, that's fine. That's their right to do. But what he was really upset about was that they shouldn't publicly raise doubts about the reliability or legitimacy of the chain of command and then do nothing about it. And that's what they had done in this hearing.
I want to talk a little bit about something you just mentioned, the human factor, and get into that a second, because as you explained it, and I've heard this elsewhere too, that this is, if you say to the military higher ups or the people involved in the decision making here, does the president have the power to start a nuclear war all by themselves? They will often say no, as you pointed out, because they're not supposed to follow illegal orders or irrational orders or all that. But at the same time, when in the hearings you just mentioned, they dialed down and got granular on that question, that's right. What they answered, kind of, that, you know, it's sort of the human question. In other words, somebody at some chain of command has to say no, and the likelihood maybe of that happening in certain situations. I mean, you mentioned in your book people that were transferred and fired simply for asking questions about how they would know if the launch orders they received were legitimate, right? That was enough to get somebody. So do we have a system that is encouraging the human factor?
No, in fact, quite the contrary. You're right. I mean, the military officers and enlisted personnel as well are trained that they should not obey, that they have an obligation to obey legal orders, which suggests that they should not obey illegal orders. But what is an illegal order? You know, there's a book, you know, the football, the thing that the guy carries around in a case next to the president all the time. It's not a button and it's not a palm print that the president lays his fingerprints in. It's a book and it has codes in it. And the codes refer to options, to attack options. And if an attack option is in that book, that means that the military lawyers have already deemed that it is legal. Now, there's all kinds of other circumstances. Well, you know, under what circumstances? But, you know, who is to determine that? Who is a one-star general the person to determine whether something is legal or not? That's generally not what he's trained for. And then here's how the chain of command works. President gets warning of something going on, or just gets it in his head. He wants to attack. There is assembled a conference call involving some cabinet people, some four-star generals, if they can be found and gathered. And there's a consultation. But ultimately, it's up to the president. In fact, the chain of command does not go through the people that he's consulted. He sends the guy carrying around the football. The president somehow authenticates who he is. The order goes to a one-star general in the National Military Command Center, which is located in the basement of the Pentagon. And that person sends the order to the submarines, the missileers, the bombers. And that's it. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Strategic Command Commander, the Secretary of Defense, they are not in that actual chain of command. There was an incident in the 70s. There was an Air Force officer named, he was a major, Harold Herring. He was a Minuteman. He, in late 73, he was training to be a Minuteman launch officer. He had been a helicopter pilot in Vietnam and so forth. And in the training center, he asked his instructors, how can I know that an order I received to launch my missiles came from a sane president? And what checks and balances exist to verify that an unlawful order does not get into the missile man? Now, these are crucial, and you would think you would want an officer who asks these kinds of questions, right? He's asking, you know, what can I do to assure that I'm not abetting a serious war crime, right? Well, he was basically taken out of the Minuteman instructor class and put before a panel, and they drummed him out of the Air Force. So, you know, the people who are in places like the National Military Command Center and the people holding the football and the people supposedly down in the missile holes and so forth, the missile silos, they are selected in part on their perceived inclination to salute and follow orders.
So, okay, so let's talk. I'm going to shift gears a little bit because that is so disturbing, but you use a word that's, and this is, so as a civilian, let's say you're an 18-year-old kid and listening to this mm-hmm. interview, that's the first you've heard of this, right? It reminds yeah. me of, and you use the description several times, the reaction to new presidents when they get that first big briefing on what the nuclear war plan is. And you used, I wrote it down several times, you used the word, the president came out appalled over and over yeah. and over again. These are intelligent yeah. people who ran for office, who were briefed all through their debates and all through the process. Some of them had political experience up to very high levels before they were elected. How can almost all these people be so changed when they come out of these meetings? How could they know so little going in theoretically versus the reality after they get the behind the scenes briefing?
Well, because it isn't something that's generally discussed, or at least not on this level. I mean, the president gets a briefing on what's called the PSYOP.
S-I-O-P. You mean the new president coming in?
Yeah, new president coming in. Single integrated operational plan. It's one of the first things, like, okay, you're the guy who might have to decide whether to go to nuclear war. Let's take you through what this involves. And they just have no idea of how. Well, I mean, it's changed over time, but let me tell you what the first PSYOP said, the one that Kennedy was briefed on. The first PSYOP where they actually integrated all of the nuclear weapons into one plan in 1960. And this was the plan, and it was the only plan, was that if the Soviet Union invaded Western Europe or grabbed West Berlin, and, you know, it wasn't something for which we had enough conventional forces to push back the invasion. The plan, the only plan, was to unleash the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal against every target in the Soviet Union, the satellite nations of Eastern Europe, and communist China, even if China hadn't been involved directly in the war. And it was estimated that this would kill about 285 million people.
In 1960.
1960. Kennedy and Eisenhower as well also received every year a briefing. There was something called the Net Evaluation Subcommittee. It was a very secretive office inside the National Security Council. Its very existence was classified. They would take the data on how many weapons we had, how many weapons it was believed the Soviet Union had, and they would run a computer-generated war game and then look at the consequences. And there was a briefing of just, you know, maybe a dozen people. And it was just appalling. It was, you know, tens of millions of people killed, tens of millions more injured, in need of hospital care for which there were no hospitals, the government completely breaking down, the economy a wreck. And when Kennedy received this briefing, he turned to Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, who was sitting next to him, and said, "And we call ourselves the human race." Now, when Eisenhower first heard this briefing, he was, and this is, you know, five-star general, Sakir, you know, World War II hero. He wrote in his diary how disturbed he was. He said, "I guess maybe the only option is to launch a preemptive first strike before this happens, but that would go against our values and Congress would never stand for it," which is kind of an interesting take. And then he said, "This only makes me more determined to keep the threshold, to keep deterrence firm." And Eisenhower, his view was, okay, we don't have conventional forces, so I'm going to put out a policy called massive retaliation, which said, you make one move into our vital interests, we will blow you to smithereens. That was the way to deter them. That's what he thought. And by this wasn't just, you know, Curtis LeMay in Strategic Air Command. This was General Eisenhower. The Joint Chiefs of Staff signed a document saying that armed conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union will go nuclear at the first opportunity, regardless of how the war was initiated.
I want to expand on that a little bit, because I know more than the average bear on this, and you still had a ton of things in the book that I'd either never heard or never saw integrated into the story well. And one of the things that you did a really good job at, and I've been meditating on it sort of ever since, is the disconnect between military leadership and political mm-hmm. leadership. I mean, I had never heard the Kissinger line that you used, that he had said, because this seems to strike against all the public released information about the president, regardless of which president's desire to maintain deterrence, especially in the 60s and 70s, where he said that Nixon would not push the button, basically, that he would not kill 80 million people. I actually quoted it. He said in a remarkable statement, your words, that he, meaning Nixon, won't push the button. He won't use nuclear weapons in a crisis, and that to only have the option of killing 80 million people is the height of immorality. I found that fascinating when you juxtaposition that sentiment, the civilian leadership sentiment, with the Curtis LeMay Strategic Air Command PSYOP mm-hmm. sentiment.
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is an. I'm going to now reveal the one thing that I got wrong in The Wizards of Armageddon. I had, which again was written 37 years ago, I had in that book that when Kennedy came in and his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, reformed the PSYOP, put in all kinds of limited options so that the first step would not be total catastrophic destruction of everything. You know, he put little, you know, we would restrain, we wouldn't attack these kinds of targets. In the first instance, we'd only attack the strategic forces, not the cities. It was very elaborate, very detailed, very sophisticated. What I learned in researching my new book is, because when I did that first book, I learned about McNamara's reforms only by interviewing people who were involved in it. There was no documents on the subject declassified yet at that point. What I learned in the new book is that the Strategic Air Command just ignored these directives. I mean, not totally. What they would do, they would get the joint staff to put little caveats like to the extent feasible, or if it is consistent with military objectives, we will do these limited options, as they were called. And then, of course, they were determined. They knew that if war actually came, they would determine that it wasn't feasible and it wasn't consistent with military objectives. So by the time Nixon becomes president and he and Kissinger get their PSYOP briefing, and, you know, Kissinger has been writing about this since the mid-50s, and he thinks that, and he'd been following, because he had been a consultant in the Kennedy administration, he knew about these options that McNamara was putting forth as directives to SAC. He was stunned that none of it had had the slightest impact. And, yeah, Nixon once gave a public speech where he talked about the need to develop some options that would not leave us the choice of surrender or suicide in the event of a war like this. So that's what he was talking about. And the line that you quoted where Kissinger says, I think Nixon just won't push the button if the only outcome is 85 million people killed, that was in a behind doors meeting of the National Security Council of his advisors. It was, you know, I got that from a top secret note taker's account of the meeting, which had recently been declassified.
Because that would destroy deterrence if something like that ever got out.
Yeah, it might. If you're saying, if the whole idea is to convince the other side that, yeah, you really are going to do this. The other side thinks that you won't do it. Well, maybe he'll get aggressive.
I was interested in sort of the polarities, and if you'll pardon the analogy, the triad of interests here that develops after the bomb is first discovered. I mean, you could talk about the Bertrand Russell, sometimes Robert Oppenheimer, we need to rid the world of past behaviors because they'll destroy us. The middle ground, which is maybe the von Neumanns and the Hermann Kahns and these people who try to figure out how to use our rationality to live with a tough situation. But then on the far side is the military. And you could say not just in our country, but also the establishment in the Soviet Union. I found it interesting when you were talking about Kissinger had talked about how, and this is what you just talked about, how unresponsive to presidential direction the military mm-hmm. was. And you don't just point out that they found wonderful little lawyer-like wiggle words in the specifics in the small print, but also they had, because I was trying to figure out in a democratic system how they worked this, and you were very clear about how they would have allies in Congress and in the Senate, you know, in the House and in the Senate, right. who controlled important committees on defense and expenditures and whatnot, and they could sort of undermine a president that they didn't like or anyone that was soft on security or what have you through their allies in the legislative branch. Is that kind of how the military was able to, in a free society where the president's supposed to hold the cards and all this, is that how they kind of counterbalanced his power?
Well, to some degree. I mean, you know, the military has also evolved over this time. I mean, the 50s and the 60s, Strategic Air Command was basically dominated by people who had been strategic bombardiers.
Second World War guys.
And you came up in the culture of of Curtis LeMay, you know, who was the first effective commander of SAC. And, you know, Curtis LeMay had fired, he had been in the head of the 21st Bomber Command in World War II. He'd been in charge of firebombing Japan. And in the spring of 1945, General Hap Arnold, who was the commander of Army Air Forces, came to him and said, "When will the war be over?" The Nazis had already surrendered. The Japanese were still fighting. LeMay took the problem to his staff. They did the math. They, you know, how much territory has been destroyed so far, how much more territory there is to go, how many bombs that'll take, how long it'll take the bombers to get there. And he came back and said, the war will be over September 1st, because that will be the time by which we will have bombed every square mile in Japan. So that was his idea of war. It's bomb everything. And when the atom bomb and then the hydrogen bomb came along, this became more appealing still. So the notion, the very notion, having this incredible weapon, that you would want to employ strategies involving restraint or using them in some limited way, struck guys like LeMay and his successor at SAC, whose name was General Tommy Power, who had been LeMay's deputy, but whom LeMay once referred to as a sadist.
Oh, God.
this notion of restraint struck them as perverse. Why would you want to restrain yourself? I mean, in this incredible moment, there was my old professor at MIT, who Bill Kaufman, who had come up with some of these ideas of restraint and counterforce and so forth, was giving Tommy Power a briefing on this. And Tommy Power pounded his fist on the table and said, "Why are you talking about restraint? Look, if at the end of the war there are two Americans and one Russian, then that means we won." And Kaufman said, "Well, you better make sure it's a man and a woman." And Power stormed out. Now, Power was an exception. Not everybody was like that, but they did have this bomb everything mentality. As time went on, the military evolved. The LeMay types died out. More people came into the command who had had experience as tactical fighter pilots or as tactical bombers. In other words, looking at military use, a military function is to go after discrete targets as you would in a military campaign, in a conventional military campaign. So things did loosen up a little bit, but still there was this, you know, SAC is out in Omaha, and LeMay and his successors exploited that fact. Yeah, they were isolated from Washington, but that also allowed them to do their own thing away from the peering eyes of Washington. And much of what they did was incredibly technical and based on very, very highly classified stuff. And so they were allowed to get away with an incredible amount of excess and really almost perverse thinking about strategy.
I was shocked, and, you know, I know quite a lot about this, but it is interesting how much of the way the whole nuclear apparatus developed could be, I mean, you might be able to make a case that one of the key reasons for it is inter-service rivalry and and jealousy over military budgets. I mean, I've never heard a better argument in my life for that age-old question about whether or not there's too much duplication and redundancy by having multiple service branches. I want to use your knowledge of this for a second. So we've been talking about the way things were, but I always think that when somebody spent as much time on a subject as you have on this, I'd like to get your own personal insights, if you don't mind for a second. But for example, we talked earlier about the command and control problem, this dicey issue of what if the situation we have now is insane, what makes more sense and is something that would work, as opposed to, you know, we can't say let's deliberate for 2 weeks. But in your mind, have you heard, talking to all these people, any reforms that would make sense in this area and that were workable?
Well, you mean about sole presidential authority?
Yeah, a way to diversify the decision making on something as big as that.
Well, there have a few times been amendments. William Proxmire offered an amendment in the 70s. Edward Markey did at this most recent hearing, which basically said that for first strikes that do not involve, you know, a response to an imminent threat, that, I don't know, either Congress gets a vote or the cabinet has to be consulted, or the sort of eight people in Congress that you consult about covert operations have to be consulted. I think that's imminently feasible. You know, the president is not facing, hey, I've only got an hour to make this decision. Why to get that kind of power? I think also, listen, believe it or not, look, there is a system where, again, eight members of Congress are let in on really every covert operation. And the people in the, they call it the Select Committee on House Intelligence and the Select Committee on Senate Intelligence. They are informed about all covert operations that the intelligence agencies do, and there's never been a leak out of these committees. You have to agree to certain things even to be on these committees. There is no such committee dealing with nuclear war planning. The Armed Services Committees of the House and Senate, they get into it in a very cursory way. They don't get, nobody is shown, not even the Secretary of Defense. He gets a briefing on the vague outlines. Nobody is shown the targeting. I have this one chapter in my book, and maybe this is what you're getting to, but even if you're not, it might be a good time to bring it up. There was no civilian interference in this and no real limited options. It was the nuclear war plan remained, you know, blow up everything, really all the way until almost the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s. And there was a civil servant, in fact, in the Pentagon named Frank Miller. And this was when first Carlucci and then Dick Cheney, of all people, was Secretary of Defense. And before he got this job, Frank, who had been working in the State Department, immersed himself in all of these documents that McNamara and McNamara's successors had written over the decades, calling for restraint and limited options and the guidance that they sent to SAC and so forth. And then he sits in on the PSYOP briefing to the Secretary of Defense. And he doesn't hear anything about this, doesn't hear anything about limit options, restraint or anything. And he says, what's going on here? And Cheney basically gave him authority to go make a deep investigation of the war plan and ordered people at SAC to let him and his staff see everything in the books. And they discovered some amazing things. So the level of overkill was just staggering. Now, we're talking about 1989 here. There were 700 nuclear weapons aimed at a 50-mile radius around Moscow. There was an air base in the Arctic Circle. It was a secondary air base. It was an air base that Russian bombers would land on their way back from having nuked the United States. And it was so cold it couldn't be used for most of the year. There were 17 nuclear weapons aimed at this base. There was an anti-ballistic missile site in Moscow that we learned later really didn't work at all. There were 69 weapons aimed at this missile site. I mean, when, there also the way target sets were targeted. For example, one target set was destroy the Russian tank army. Okay. Well, what they did, it wasn't even just destroying just the tanks. They also destroyed the factory that made the tanks, the factory that made spare parts for the tanks, the factory that made it rolled the steel to make the tanks, the mines. Where, I mean, it, you know, went on and on like that. It was just incredibly redundant. And then here came the kicker. Here came the thing that blew the whole system apart. At this point, George H.W. Bush was negotiating a strategic arms treaty with the Russians. And one of Frank's staffers, a guy named Gil Klinger, asked his contact at the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, which was the division of SAC that actually did the mechanical targeting of a war plan. He said, you know, they're thinking of lowering the number of nuclear weapons to such and such. Would you still be able to perform your mission with so few weapons? And the guy said, well, no, that's not how we think about this. And he goes, well, what I mean, no, I understand what you mean, but that's not what we do. What we do, we take the number of weapons that are given to us and we apply them to the targets that are on our lists. Now, the implications of this are insane. It means that at no point had anybody in the operational side of this asked, well, how many weapons do we really need to perform whatever mission it is they want to perform? No, it was there was a SAC commander named Jack Chain who, one hearing in the 90s, or I guess it was the late 80s, said, I need 10,000 weapons because I have 10,000 targets. And people thought he was either joking or maybe he wasn't very bright. But no, that is exactly how it worked. It was a completely out of control process with no reference to policy or aims or proportionality. And this is what happens when you let a very powerful, highly, highly specialized bureaucracy go completely rogue, go completely independent with no oversight, even from the people who are actually setting the policies that this bureaucracy was set up to implement.
Now, we've been talking about high-minded stuff and policy and all these kinds of things, which is fascinating, but I think we should not lose track of what you point out in the book over and over, and what is the key issue here, and it's bodies on the ground, right? Bertrand Russell's I Dream of London in Ruins with Corpses Everywhere. You know, I was wondering about humankind's ability to stay on a knife's edge of concern and alert generation after generation. I think maybe after thinking about this, that it might almost be an evolutionary help that we don't continually worry about nuclear weapons to the same degree that we did in like 1955. And yet, if we don't, do we risk presidential campaigns where we're talking about minutiae and small little opinion things or optics things that don't matter at the expense of talking about some of the very important things we talked about here? How can you keep something this important and this almost impossible in your mind to imagine thing? How can you keep this at the height of the triage alert level indefinitely?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think, look, you and I are sitting here. You know, I'm 65 years old.
I'm 54. Maybe
I've got another 15 years. I don't think about this every day. Maybe I should. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that we don't think about. I mean, much of what we do in life is kind of an evasion. I mean, and this, of course, what we're talking about, nuclear war, is a super evasion. But you know, this does lead to one thing that you mentioned a little earlier about presidents versus the generals. Now, the subtitle of this book is Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. And one thing that I found consistent leading up to the current president, who hasn't yet been tested on this, but about whom one can make some inferences, is that a lot of these presidents, more than we realize, faced crises in which the use of nuclear weapons was seriously contemplated. And the records show that they immersed themselves very deeply in the logic, in the strategy, in the scenarios, and in the consequences. And they were led through this by briefers who spoke of it in very calm and rational terms, in some cases advocating certain kinds of uses of nuclear weapons. And in every case, when the president got to the bottom of this rabbit hole, he realized, no, I am not going to go there. The consequences are just too catastrophic. And they figured out some way to scramble out of the rabbit hole and to settle this crisis through some diplomatic solution. And, you know, you can ask, why is it? I think if you had gone back to 1947, say, and asked somebody there, what do you think the chances are that we'll get to the year 2020 and never use these nuclear weapons again? Nobody uses them. I don't think you'd find very many people who would think that was a possibility. I think you'd be seen as a naive or an excessive optimist if you said, yeah, I think that's possible. And yet we've done it. We've done it. So why is that? I think it's three things. One thing, I think, you know, nuclear deterrence, I mean, you know, it's a powerful thing. It's not a lifetime guarantee, but the idea that if you start messing around that the other person will strike back and destroy you, that's a restraining influence. The second part is that, as I've discovered in this book, we've been blessed with leaders who, in a pinch, turn out to be fairly shrewd and rational, at least when it comes to this sort of thing. And three, we've had good luck. I mean, there have been lots of accounts of, you know, incidents in which, you know, a flock of geese, just somebody looks out on a radar screen that looks like missiles coming their way, or a software error that makes it look like that missiles are coming our way. And there's somebody in the middle level of the command who decides, yeah, this probably isn't real, and does nothing about it. So we've had, it's a combination of deterrence, shrewd leaders, and good luck. But what happens if we have a situation where we have slow-witted leaders and a spate of bad luck? And that's a combination that, you know, the dice are going to come up that way at some point. Even if they haven't just yet, and then what happens? That's the sort of frightening thing.
And not to change the subject, but to leave it on a note that I found another fascinating thing. And like I said, I know quite a bit about this, and you threw things out there where I was like, wow, I didn't know that, or I didn't realize that, or I didn't internalize that. I was fascinated by how the different presidents sort of dealt with this issue in a way that sort of matched their personality. So watching an Eisenhower try to figure out how to deal with this versus a Kennedy. And then when you got to Reagan, I found that so interesting, because instead of doing it at like an Eisenhower level or a Kennedy level, where he was looking at the giant Dr. Strange love and von Neumann side of this, he took it down to a human level. I love that story where I'm going to let you tell it because you'll tell it better. But where Reagan and Gorbachev, right when they're at this, you know, they had been at a knife's edge with Andropov and Brezhnev and the various leadership that was dying left and right. Then you get this transformative first person Gorbachev in an environment where everybody distrusts one another, and Reagan, the ultimate Cold Warrior. You know, we start bombing in 5 minutes. That guy sends everybody else away, and with just the translators, gets Gorbachev on a couch, and brings it down to a level far below the Rand Institute level, and just gets it to a real human thing. Can you tell the story about the aliens?
Yeah, well, you know, Reagan. You know, I was a reporter. I was covering Reagan, and he turns out to be a more complicated figure than I thought. For one thing, he was kind of a secret nuclear abolitionist. His staff tried to keep this from everybody, but this was why he was in favor of Star Wars, Strategic Defense Initiative. He might have been one of two or three people who really thought that's what that program was about, which was to kind of erect a shield that would keep all nuclear weapons out, rendering them impotent or obsolete. First term, he comes in, boosts the budget, makes all kinds of provocative statements about the Soviet Union. The NSA and CIA are doing incredibly provocative things. And then Reagan realizes that the Soviets believe that we're setting up to launch a first strike. And he says, oh, God, we have to start dialing this back. And he reaches out to a Soviet leader. As you say, a couple of them died. Then he goes to meet with Gorbachev. This is in 1985 in Geneva. And their first round of talks is kind of tense. And so they go for a walk along the lake, and they duck into a cabin where a fire is roaring, and it's just them and their translators and note takers. Reagan leans in and says, if the United States were attacked by aliens from outer space, would Russia come to our defense? And Gorbachev says, absolutely. And Reagan says, I feel the same way about you. And so when they came back to the conference room, Secretary of State George Shultz, who had no inkling of this conversation until much, much later, wrote in his account of this that all of a sudden the atmosphere had changed completely. These two guys were laughing and joking like they were old friends. And that's what led to the sort of pivot away from Cold War to the end of the Cold War. And this was something real to Reagan. A couple of years later, Reagan wrote a speech to the UN General Assembly. And Colin Powell tried to excise this line that I'm about to recite a couple of times, and Reagan kept adding it back in. And it was this. He said, if we were attacked by aliens from outer space, the quarrels and disputes between us here on Earth would seem trivial by comparison. Now, on the one hand, this is kind of nutty, right? But on the other hand, hey, you know, he has a point. And maybe when you're dealing with a subject that is cataclysmically catastrophic, maybe a view from a billion miles up is not a bad way to go.
Holy cow, is that the best ending I could ever think of for an interview? why do we call it quits here unless there was something that I left out that you really want to include? Please bring that up.
You know, I mean, there is, you know, if you wanted to talk about and insert, you know, things about the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Berlin Crisis or, but whatever, you know, you certainly asked a lot of questions that nobody's ever asked before.
My thanks to Fred Kaplan for coming on the program. The book is called The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Available right now. You can also check out his column, his regular column, War Stories in Slate Magazine. And my goodness, if you're into this stuff, and it's a fascinating book about trying to figure out the most logical ways for human beings to live with the ever-increasing power of their weapon systems, check out Fred Kaplan's earlier work, The Wizards of Armageddon. Fascinating stuff. We appreciate him coming on the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Have you seen 1917 yet in the theater? The reason I ask is because it's one of those films that if you are a fan of filmmaking you can't take your eyes off the way they did it from a cinematographer standpoint. I mean, there's a reason people oohed and awed about it when they saw it, and it wasn't necessarily the sort of things that speak to yours truly. I'm going to go to a First World War film that's done like this because there haven't been many of them. We've talked about that in the past, so I'm already hooked before you even show me how you shot it. But then when you show me how you shot it, I couldn't take my eyes off it. Now, I don't talk about this very much, but I come from a family of film people. And knowing how stuff is done and watching how scenes are shot and the way they're framed and all this kind of stuff kind of is a second nature discussion around the dinner table when I was a kid. And I'm watching this and all I could think about was, oh, you know, I really missed my dad at that moment. When you want to have your dad back and you want to show it to him and you want to just say, Dad, what do you think of that? And just get his feedback, because if you don't know, if you haven't read anything about this, you're not like the fly on the wall or the spider up in the corner of the room. You're there. The way they shot it, you're like on the mission with the people in the mission. And so you feel like you are in real time here. Like almost, I felt like sometimes like I was looking through my own eyes, but then they'd spin the camera around and you'd be like, ooh. I found myself thinking of all the other subjects besides the First World War that you could give this kind of treatment to and how interesting and weird and wild it would be in all those circumstances.
it did change the feel of the film, made it a very unique sort of feel, because it didn't feel like there are certain kinds of reactions. You get out of the theater and you go, oh, I have this. I mean, I remember with Platoon, it was like I'd been hit in the face with a sledgehammer. There was a mood. And a lot of these films where war is a part of it, you get this a different feel, not necessarily the Platoon feel, but a different feel when you walk out. This was much more the way they shot it, turned it into an edge of your seat thriller suspense thing that reminded me more of some of the really well done horror movies when I was a teenager, and you would just go, holy cow, there's some kind of dopamine or something that it's pumped into my brain, because I felt like I was on the edge of my, anything could happen to me at any time. I felt the same way in 1917. I didn't feel like I was watching one of these war films where there are tens of thousands of people in a panoramic, you know, fields of glory or paths of glory type of movie. It was much more of a, holy cow, my heart rate is up, and I feel like I've actually gone on this mission with these guys. I loved it. I thought they did a great job, and so did the, you know, Academy of Motion Pictures, obviously, too. This is the kind of film you're going to want to splurge for the extra clarity and all that, because they did a fantastic job. If you want to hear how they did it, by the way, I'm told there's going to be some fabulous bonus content along with all this. You'll get the whole story on the behind-the-scenes cinematic ideas, the music was fantastic. The soundtrack was fantastic. Exclusive interviews with the cast and production crew. Commentary by director and co-writer Sam Mendes and the director of photography. Well worth your time. Enjoy it. It's available to own March 10th, 2020 on digital streaming. And, of course, March 24th for those of you who want to see it in 4K, Ultra HD, or Blu-ray. And I just have to tell you, this is the kind of film you're going to want to splurge for the extra clarity and all that, because they did a fantastic job.